I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio. More than 10 years ago, we saw the dot-com bubble burst. Today, we're slogging through the wreckage left by the housing market collapse. And now there are economists saying that there could be more bubbles expanding on the horizon, like the rental market and student loan debt. Joining me in Studio 3 is someone who's bursting a lot of bubbles with his theory on why bubbles burst. That's Paul Willen, an economist at the Boston Fed. He's the subject of a recent Boston Globe article where he's quoted as saying, if it was really clear when there was a bubble, the bubbles would never happen in the first place. And before we dive into the conversation, I want to be clear that Paul is speaking today as a researcher and a citizen, not as a representative of the Boston Fed or of the Federal Reserve System. Paul Willen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start, because our conversation is about the housing bubble and what it says and doesn't say, as you know it to be. The conventional wisdom was housing bubble caused the crash. You know, too many people bought bad more house than they could afford, borrowed against a house that the value was inflated, or financial companies that were greedy knew this, flooded the market with bad mortgages and made big bucks. So that's the conventional wisdom. And initially, you agreed with the conventional wisdom, but then you started thinking there was more to the story. Tell me why.
Well, I think to explain what the conventional wisdom was and remains, I think a lot of people still view the housing bubble as really an effect of a bunch of other things that were happening that were the real cause of the crisis. And so according to this conventional narrative, it puts deception and bad behavior at the heart of this. And so there were the people who knew what was going on, the insiders, the mortgage bankers, the mortgage brokers, the investment bankers. They knew borrowers couldn't afford loans. They knew that the securities were bad. And the story is that they took advantage of all these innocent people to make money for themselves and left everybody else holding the bag. And I think the main, you know, the first thing that I think we, you know, that there are, it's not to say that that people won't take advantage of you and that mortgage bankers,
aren't greedy,
okay. But they've always been greedy. I think one of the questions was, that's exactly right. Yeah. People said to me at some point, you know, well, what, we'd all know what caused this. It was greed. And then you say, but we've had greed now for thousands of years. Why did greed become a problem in 2004? And so I think what we've argued is that what was going on in that what we claim to document is that when you look at the data, you don't really find much support for that story. The people on the inside, supposedly, seem to have been just as lost a lot of money and seem to be just as confused about what was going on as anyone else. And so what we keep pointing to is that when you're in a bubble or when you're in this kind of collective mania, whatever you want to call it, people make decisions that appear to make a lot of sense. In hindsight, they seem crazy. I mean, it seemed crazy when you look at it that lenders would give loans to people with trouble, with a history of not repaying debt, who can't document their income, and who don't put any money down. You look at that and you say, that's crazy. But then what were the lenders thinking? Well, they were thinking, and the investors who were buying these loans thinking, they were thinking, well, house prices just, they go up all the time. They've been going up now for years. They're going to continue going up. So I don't really care whether this borrower can repay the loan. They can always sell the house. And that was the logic. And I think that's what we always have to be careful about, is that when you get into a situation like that, it's very, very difficult for people to tell that something bad can happen.
So let's underscore what you just said about those bankers saying, well, I don't care whether they can pay it back or not because it's going to come back up again, so I'll get my money. We'll all be happy together.
Right.
What was pointed out in Leon Nafa's piece is that during this period of time or before, leading up to this period of time, there were some 700 pieces of legislation which allowed for people to use the equity in their house. So, of course, if I'm looking at, you know, what laws are being passed to make it easier for me, why would I not believe that this is happening for a while, that we're on an upward trend and we're going to stay there, even if it dips a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to be careful. The 700 that's nonsense. I mean, there were 700 laws. Congress passed something like 1,400 laws over that period. I don't know where this 700 figure, I think, comes from basically saying any law that in any way affects anybody who owns a home is somehow made it easier to borrow. So that statistic is...
But here's the point. There were a lot of this,
there were a lot of stuff out there. Actually one of the things we point out in the paper is that it was actually over the period, over this period, there was actually surprisingly little. So, for example, people say, oh, in the old days, they didn't give, you know, they required 20% down on a mortgage. But in fact, if you go and you look at the historical record, the federal government has been encouraging zero down lending since the Second World War. The Veterans Administration, one of the key parts of the GI Bill, was allowing returning veterans to buy houses with zero down. Zero down, not 5% down, not 3% down, but really with zero down. And so you see throughout the 40s and 50s and 60s, a large fraction of Americans bought homes with very little money down. So there's
It can be argued those are specialized populations, right?
No, they was the FHA went, so there was the Veterans Administration, which just focused on, well, also remember returning veterans is something like half of all new homeowners. I mean, it's
so
a
you're
huge
saying a large
specialized
population.
It's a huge group of people, yeah.
Right.
And then,
okay.
And the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA, expanded these programs to large numbers of people. And it was always understood that these were risky loans, and they always accounted for a disproportionate share of delinquencies. But there was a policy decision which seemed to be working for many years that that was a small price to pay for expanded access to homeownership. And I think that was a trade-off that for many years seemed to be a good trade-off, a trade-off we were willing to make. It was only it's only recently that people have really began to question that.
All right. So my guest is Paul Willen. He is a research economist at the Boston Fed, but he is speaking for himself as a researcher and citizen today. And we're talking about why conventional wisdom existed and still continues to exist, that the bubble brought us all down, when in fact Paul Willen's research has shown that we couldn't have known what was going to happen. People weren't in fact evil or knew what could see through ahead with the crystal ball. We were in the bubble, literally.
In some sense, the point about a bubble is that the whole point of it is that it's about people believing. The whole point of it is that everybody believes that something has changed and that somehow the world has changed and now houses that were worth $100,000 really are worth $200,000, and it's very difficult. I think one of the things that we tried to argue is that economics as a science does not allow you to answer these questions. It doesn't have tools yet. Who knows whether it will, but right now it's not like a doctor who can diagnose a disease and they can say this person is suffering from malaria or this person is suffering from has the flu. Doctors can say that. We don't have those sorts of tools yet, and I think one of the problems is that people think we do, and so they're inclined to trust that we'll be able to tell when house prices are going to fall.
Well, what's interesting is in the piece, here's a quote from the piece, nothing in economic theory, to back up what you just said, can allow for us to detect when something costs more than it's worth or is inflated or about to collapse. Well, okay, that seems to go against everything that we, the little people, understand about you, the economist. And I would go back to your example of using the doctors. A doctor also has, a basis, but he doesn't absolutely know if I hit the
absolutely.
Door, if I've got pneumonia or if I've got the
absolutely.
Flu. He's using measures of exclusion that he's been trained to use.
Right.
I assume you and your ilk, all
yep.
economists,
yep.
are trained to use measures
absolutely.
Of exclusion. So then why you then at a moment said, somehow this is not working for me, and I figured out that everybody else is more to this story. Why?
I don't know. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think one of the things you can tell, you somehow makes you trust a doctor, me at least, is when they say I don't know, and I think as in our when we talk with each other, economists, we're actually much more humble and much more willing to say we don't know. But I think when we talk with the rest of the world, there's this expectation that we have to have an answer and that we have to be able to answer these questions. And I think there's also a certain amount of selection that goes on that people, reporters listen to. You know, if you say, if someone calls you up and you say, I have the faintest idea what's happening with house prices, they're going to say, I'm not calling that guy again. And but if you say house prices are going to go up 10% for the next 3 years and then stabilize, they say, now here's someone. And I think there is a bit of a temptation to give. There's a sort of behavioral desire to tell people what they want to hear, okay, which is to have answers.
All right, so Paul Willen, I keep asking this, and you're not answering me. What made you?
Me personally?
Yes,
I don't
because
know.
You start, I mean.
I actually think we, I'll tell you what made us, why us? That is a good question. I think one of the reasons was that we actually started doing research on the housing crisis here in Boston a little sooner than everyone else, and part of that was there were two sort of factors that just somehow were luck. One of them was that we had a very close relationship or built a close relationship with the community affairs at the Boston Fed. That may be why we were. And so we started hearing about foreclosure problems really at the beginning of 2006. So I remember this, the first time someone invited me to participate on a panel called Foreclosure Crisis. And that was in the beginning of 2006, and that was partly because the foreclosure crisis started here about a year before it started in the rest of the country. And so I think by the time the crisis became a national issue, we had really been thinking about this for more than a year. We'd really been thinking about it much longer than everyone else. The other thing I think also is that we actually started doing research on mortgages, trying to understand this while it was going on. So we actually started doing research on a lot of people have attributed the crisis, and they talk a lot about alternative mortgage products that allowed borrowers rather than pay off the mortgage, to just pay the interest or sometimes pay even less. And those were sort of a big issue in the public debate in 2004 and 2005, and that's how I got interested in mortgages. So I remember I was sort of there. We were doing research on this while it was happening, and we were asking lenders. We had people from the rating agencies and people from Bear Stearns and people. And, you know, I could tell, you know, talking to them, these were serious people. The people I talked to were researchers. They were not salespeople. They were not trying to pull over anything. And I could ask them, why do you think this is a good idea? And they would say, look, these loans have performed well because house prices are going up. And as long as house prices are going up, these loans will perform well. And I think that gave us an insight that people who came to this in 2007 and 2008 couldn't have, because by that time, the guys at Bear Stearns had been discredited and vilified, and finally, they were out of business. And so it was easy to think that these guys were up to no good.
So just to be clear for all of us, that, you know, this is not the kind of cocktail conversation for you where you say to your friend, you know, I don't think people know what they're talking about.
No.
You know, you really sat down,
yes,
and pieced together data that huge amounts of data that you've been poring over and looking at for now some 4 years.
Yes.
You've been talking about this out in the field among your economists who are, it's fair to say, not really happy with you.
I don't think that's quite fair in the sense that I think there are, I mean, there's been a lot of debate. I think there are some who agree with me, and there's some, and I think I've successfully convinced some. So I don't think that's quite fair. I mean, I think people are open, but then I think there's also been a lot of, there has been a fair amount of resistance to it, as evidenced by the quotes that Leon had from some economists who I think want to believe that there's a kind of, it's a very funny way to put it, but a kind of rational explanation for the crisis, and who are uncomfortable with the idea that there's this, that what happened in the house prices, what happened in housing markets, that at some level there's something there we don't understand. And I think, to me, to say, as someone did, that it's sort of a cop-out to say we don't understand why house prices went up, I disagree. On the contrary, I feel like that's science. So, you know, if you say parasites cause a disease, and someone comes and says, well, that's not a good explanation because he can't explain where the parasites came from. That's right. We have something we need to understand. And I think understanding what happened, I think there, to say that what happened in, as the critic who Leon quoted about the 700 laws says, oh, the crisis is completely explainable by rational
factors.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very dangerous thing. Just right now, if we saw house prices going up rapidly again, would we say, oh, because policies have changed, that can't be a bubble. Mm-hmm. That must be completely logical, and therefore there's no need for any policy response. That would be very dangerous. And just if you convince yourself we understand this all, it all makes sense, then you're going to convince yourself that if we take these specific policy actions, we will never have a bubble again. That would be a very rash and risky thing to do, given how little we understand of what happened.
Well, I want you also to respond to, because there's criticism about there's no rational way to do it, but there's also criticism that says, yeah, you're a guy that works for the Fed, and the Fed had some responsibility in this. And come on, you're just looking for, with all your data points, looking for some way to excuse the Fed's role. Respond to that.
I think that's absurd. I think the theories that we critique are theories that have been espoused by many people within the Federal Reserve System. That's the first thing. I think the second thing is that, you know, one of the great criticisms of the Fed is, so the critic says, oh, we failed to regulate. We had very limited, the Fed, I wasn't even there at the time, when a lot of this stuff was there, and I certainly had no ability to do any regulation. That's above my pay grade. We had limited power to regulate. I think what a lot of people blame the Fed for is for having caused the bubble by lowering interest rates and for having and not having recognized that house prices were going to fall. I think it's bizarre to suggest that our story in any way exonerates the Fed. Now, one can debate about whether the low interest rates really caused the bubble. That's a whole separate question to which we provide no, that is not something that we have anything to say about. But my point here is that this is not a story that in any way exonerates the Fed. The Fed, like lots of people, I think what you can say, what's on the record, is that I think the Federal Reserve officials did not really appreciate how vulnerable the financial system was to falling prices. So I don't think this explanation in any way exonerates the Fed. That's a preposterous statement. And, in my life, no one has ever accused me of being a team player that way. So that was a funny thing to say.
All right. My guest is Paul Willen. He's an economist at the Boston Fed, not speaking for the Fed today. He's speaking for himself as a researcher and a citizen. And we're talking about the housing bubble, its impact on the economy, and whether economists really understood what was going on enough to now say we could avoid it, a bubble. And you say no. In fact, you use stronger language. You said mass delusion is really what all of us sort of bought into when we accepted the fact.
I think the bubble is a very hard thing to exactly, it's a word that has all kinds of different meanings. But I think it's the easiest way to talk about this is to say that I think one phrase economists have come to use is distorted beliefs. The mass delusion, yes, it was a situation in which a lot of people believed something, and that was sort of self-reinforcing. And out of that came a conviction that there were a lot of what appear, you know, to some people at the time, and certainly in hindsight, very risky things, which people were able to convince themselves weren't risky because they saw a lot of other people doing them, and they could come up with a story for why it was a good idea.
So as I'm reading your story and you know, going through your theories about this, I was reminded of Facebook. Everybody said, this is it. You know, this thing is going to make gazillions of money. And okay, so it might dip a little, but it'll come back. That's what they said, right? And it's dropped like a stone, I think. That's fair to say.
I think Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I mean, I think what's hard, it's easy always in hindsight, but, you know, there have been things, you know, you might have thought the same thing about Google. You know, yeah. If you told me in 1998 this search thing is going to be a major...
I would disagree with you to say, because okay. Google people said, well, you know, it's a new thing, we're not quite sure. Yep. With Facebook, yep. That it was said with a great amount of certainty.
Yeah.
This is the deal.
Yep.
If anything is going to make it, come on.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're okay. Right. You're absolutely right. And I think it's just hard. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think, I think the problem with asset prices, this is a problem with house prices, the problem with stocks is that the price of it reflects the views of the people who are buying it. So if people think it's a good idea, that drives the price up. And one of the problems is that then people see the price going up and that confirms their beliefs. And so they say, see, I was right, even though in some sense, it was their collective belief that
mass
pushed
delusion.
The price up. That's the mass delusion. And that's the thing, and that's what happens with housing, is you say to people, you know, house prices, that's crazy. You say to someone in Las Vegas, house prices aren't going to go up 10% a year. And then they say, no, you're wrong, and they all buy, and house prices do go up 10%, and they say, see, you were wrong. And that's, I mean, I think it's hard. I mean, when you look back on it, there was a colleague of mine actually at the Board of Governors, so in the Federal Reserve, who said in 2003 that house prices were going to fall, in 2004 that house prices were going to fall, in 2005, and every year he was just spectacularly wrong. House prices, every time he said it, they didn't just go up. They went up more than they had the previous year. And he said to me, this was actually, I think in 2006, he said, you know, if I worked in the private sector, I would have been fired. Years ago, and finally he was right. But it was after years and years and years of being wrong and having all the people who said no, this is going to go on forever, and they were saying, "See, I told you so." And he had to listen to that for 4 years.
So, Paul Whelan, let me ask this question, because whenever there's someone who comes along who is running against the tide, as you are with your data and your theory derived from your data, that's a hard place to be because you set yourself up for many things. I was reminded, actually, by reading about your story about the doctor who said in 2005, ulcers are not caused by stress. They are caused by bacteria.
That's right.
People laughed in his face.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody remembers that now, but it was ugly.
Yep.
So I'm wondering, what is it like for you to be at a point, researcher, private citizen, not speaking for the Boston Fed, Paul Whelan, data that says something totally different from, I think, the body of economists. What does that feel like?
There are times when you get abused, but then I think there's always something when you're learning that's it's sort of exhilarating, and when you're I think Leon described in the paper one of the kind of key insights we had was something on which we had one idea and then it turned out we were wrong, and I have very fond memories. That was a kind of great moment in my life as an economist to have something where you think, wow. You know, I mean, I really resisted it. I mean, my collaborator was running this model and he kept coming back to me and saying, no, that's not what we find. And I'm like, you must be doing something wrong. And then I thought, wait a minute, maybe we're wrong. Maybe what we're finding is actually right. And I had been, you know, reading these analyst reports from the banks and trying somehow to shoehorn what I was beginning to see was evidence that they did understand how these mortgages were performed with my theory that they didn't. And there's this moment where you're like, wait a minute. And there's this sort of, so I think that's why you go into research. I, that's what's exciting about it is finding out that you're wrong.
All right. So, you've given us a lot to think about.
Well, thank you.
I guess you can be a maverick even if you're an economist.
Well, a little bit.
Thank you so much for this interesting conversation. We've been talking about financial bubbles, asking if they can really be foreseen before they burst. And I've been speaking with Paul Whelan. He's an economist at the Boston Fed. His views here today are his only. He is not representing the Boston Fed or the Federal Reserve System. To learn more about Paul Whelan's views, check out the profile on him in last week's Boston Globe Ideas section. We usually think about using coupons and think they'll save us money, but there are some critics who say that's not the case. We'll look at how lifting the ban on prescription drug coupons in the Bay State could actually drive up healthcare costs. I'm Callie Crossley. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.